very exhilarating to have shared an experience in depth with another person the way you do with an analyst. You know the inner workings of people's struggles, of their strengths, of the things they overcome. It's, you know, we're granted such a privilege to be part of someone's world and to be able to help them get more freedom and more pleasure in that world. And when it works well, I think we, like the patients, are really exhilarated at the end.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Judy Kantrowitz. Dr. Kantrowitz is a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, and she is the author of four books: The Patient's Impact on the Analyst, Writing About Patients, Responsibilities, Risks, and Ramifications, Myths of Termination, What Patients Can Teach Analysts About Ending. This is the focus of our conversation today. And most recently, the role of patient-analyst match in the process and outcome of psychoanalysis. She's written over 40 papers in addition. And I would recommend, if you want, to take a look at the paragraph, the biographical paragraph that I've included in the podcast notes. It's essentially been written by Judy, and I wanted her voice to come across in the same spirit that she invites the people she interviews, their voice to come across. What she has done in this book is interview 82 individuals who have completed analyses and have had various termination experiences. And she invites them to talk about the termination, to talk about what happened in the analysis in the termination, what happens in their mind during and after the termination, and what happens for some of them in their post-analytic contacts with their analysts. And the conclusion she draws from this research is what we've been taught isn't quite accurate. And she set out to expand our understanding, not based on theory, but based on hearing the words of the individuals who went through the experience. I found it quite fascinating. Her love of the work is palpable, and the honesty with which we close this interview when she shares with us some of the personal meanings that this work has had for her is deeply moving and touching. I hope you find it as important as I do. Here is my conversation with Dr. Judy Kantrowitz. Judy, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here. Judy, you have devoted yourself to the subject of termination. You've put together a remarkable book. I have it right here. It's called Myths of Termination, What Patients Can Teach Psychoanalysts About Endings. And your title there is quite to the point, What Patients Can Teach Psychoanalysts About Endings, because the book is about interviewing Anna Lassands, who had meaningful psychoanalytic experiences and meaningful terminations. And you ask them about their terminations. That in and of itself is a major contribution to our field because we don't usually have that information. But what I want to emphasize is that you did this with 82 individuals. Now, I guess for statisticians, 82 may not be a significant number, but certainly for analysts, 82 is an enormous number. No one person obviously has that experience, or even a collection of people if they were to sit around talking about their termination experiences with analysts. And you just don't come up with this amount of information. So you've shed light on the truth of termination. And that's in contrast to the myth of termination, as you characterize the book. And what I have learned from reading and rereading your book, the overarching take-home message for me is that there is no formula. As you very simply and beautifully put it at the beginning of the book, quote, there are countless ways of having a good enough ending. And just to compare some of your findings with some of the shibboleths, perhaps, the truths that we've been taught, you have found that rarely is there a return of symptoms, something that's passed on to this day in termination courses. You also found that many analyses end unilaterally. Now, that can include analysts needing to move, financial difficulties, or their spouses or partners change. There are those reality factors on the part of the analyst and the analyst of all sorts of reality factors. And you also make the point that at times analysts will bring up termination as an interpretation, that is, as an interpretation of the patient's denial of time. That for those analysts that are not living in vivo, the analyst might say, you know, time is passing. You also discover that the majority of analysts in some way or another reconnect with their analyst. That can be a one-off consultation. It could be a brief psychotherapy or even some returning to analysis. That is more the rule than the exception. Then there's the fascinating and nuanced question that you researched about post-termination, how does one internalize one's analyst or one's analytic process? There is a literature on differentiating the two, that ideally, and that's in quotations, ideally, the best outcome is said to be when the process is internalized, as contrasted with internalizing the person of the analyst. You actually have data on that subject, and it's far more nuanced than that, and we're going to talk about that. Another fascinating finding is that there is not always intense grief at the end of an analysis. At times, patients report a sense of buoyancy. Now, the first question one would ask is this a defensive buoyancy? Is this a hypomanic buoyancy? And the data you gathered is quite clear that it is not that, that the buoyancy comes from a sense of accomplishment. A pride, a self-sufficiency. And we're going to talk about that. One of the questions that brought to my mind, while this is not a book about how analysts feel about their terminations, I wondered about whether analysts too feel a sense of buoyancy and might feel a little bashful about sharing that. And another conclusion is that the full benefit of analysis isn't realized often until after the analysis is over. I could go on because it's so rich with meaningful insights, and I might add the absence of theory. This is not a book on theory. This is a book on what is it like for people to go through and complete an analysis. Judy, tell us about it. What brought you to do this work, which took you years?
Well, I think what you've asked me really is, well, why did I do this to begin with? And you've addressed one of the major reasons, which is that there's something in the literature that wrote about termination as if it were one thing, as if there were really steps you had to undertake and that's what people did. And you know, I was suspicious of that, and my own experience in treating, obviously not 82 patients, but a fair number of patients in analysis, didn't support that at all, that it was very individual. But, you know, one of the things for us as analysts, we only see so many patients. So I've sort of learned with a model that I've taken from Bob Wallerstein that there's a real a contribution, I guess I'd say, to be made by having more data than that. And so I asked for volunteers to talk to me about their experiences. Let me say, though, about this, because this data is colored by the nature of volunteers and probably should be something we think about here, too, which is that volunteers, I really have discovered, volunteer because of very positive and very negative experiences. So in some way, it may not be totally representative, but it is certainly true of both of these groups and, you know, what they told me. So at least one of the things I did want to show was that, in fact, there is no formula like this. It's specificity, not generalizations, that we can make when we talk about endings. The other thing is that the accounts in our literature are from analysts talking about their patients. We don't have the patient's voice. And I wanted to have the patient's voice because it's a different perspective. And we, who have been analyzed too, have our own experience, but that's an N of one. So this is not contaminated by our having treated the patients, but they're speaking for themselves in this way. It seemed to me that this was an important thing. And to have, as you point out, a larger number, that seemed to me to offer something. 82 is not a huge number, but it's certainly more than any of us will see in our own consulting rooms.
Was there something that stood out that most surprised you?
I wasn't surprised about the diversity. That's kind of what I was hoping I was going to be able to show. And I wasn't surprised about the issue of not everyone grieving. That also made some sense to me. Maybe what I was most surprised about was the extent to which analysts had difficulty in separating and would also often, it's not a nice way of putting it, but in a sense, intrude in their patients' lives afterwards in ways that weren't welcome. I mean, I think the things that surprised me were not from the analyses where people came to report things that were, you know, that were good, although I think they were rather specific. But what surprised me were when people called me and wanted to talk about what they were angry about. And there were things like analysts being the ones who didn't want them to end when they wanted to end, or didn't want them to end the way they wanted to end. The amount of things that were imposed on them, the amount of complaint that came from patients feeling that their analysts disrupted either the analysis or the ending, and things like unwanted self-disclosures. I think many things that analysts thought would be welcome weren't welcome. And also some things that I know we're going to talk about later about post-analytic contact. But I think that it's where the unhappiness was that, again, not that I'm totally surprised because I knew from other work that, in fact, things like this happened, but the amount to which analysts not remaining as analysts really disrupted what could have been analytic gains for people. So that, I think that was the most surprising thing for me.
And you referred to two categories of analysts being other than analysts, that is during the treatment and after the treatment, which are different they're different animals.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. But I think it speaks to which, to the sense to which one's analysis stays with one. And this actually goes to this question that you're asking about the internalization of the process or the analyst. And obviously, you know, it's both. You know, one of the myths that I think we've had, and one of the things that really is interesting, is the valorization of self-sufficiency in a way that I'm going to say something paradoxical about it, because in fact, the people who have all the buoyancy, in fact, are a special category under this. But the notion that I think went, you know, with a general philosophy and fitting with the early ego psychology, and has certainly changed as the sensitivity to the analyst as a real person, as the interpersonal aspects of it. But I think the idea that that there was a hierarchy of thinking of independence, and in fact, the extent to which an analysis is helpful is not really dependent on it in that way. People are different. Some people think Geller and Friedman have an interesting thing. They talk about post-analytic work or post-therapy work as conversations with themselves, which would be the ideal sort of that we used to have of the internalization process, or conversation with others. And it was viewed that this conversation with others was a more dependent, less evolved being. I don't think we think of it quite like this. Some of us never thought of it quite like that, but certainly this, the idea of this real independence in this way, of not needing the other, you know, it's you want to be able to be independent, but you also want to be able to be intimate. And different people do these in different ways. So what's useful to one person is not necessarily useful to another.
You have a beautiful sentence that describes this. Your sentence is, mastery of neurotic dependency should enhance relatedness, not replace it with isolation.
Right, exactly.
Gets to your point. Well, let's take up this question of the introjection of the literal analyst and the analyzing function. Certainly when I was in training, it was taught that there is a virtue in not personalizing one's introject post-analysis, that it's the process, and that's a higher level of functioning because it's abstracted. And what you found is that people are always doing both. Mm-hmm. People are at times internalizing the process and using it in a self-analytic function. And at other times, they hear their analyst speaking, or they picture them visually, or they feel supported, or in some way, it's their picture of the person, which is just that, is an important finding. For those who may have thought each time they think of their analyst that they're failing in some way, your work is reassuring that saying, you know, we're all doing both, more or less.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that I think, you know, I think we've changed as a field in thinking about this. But I do think there was this valorization of this kind of independence. And you don't want a defensive independence that's not connected with people. You do want people to be able to do things themselves. But the notion of interconnection is an important one. And people vary about one or the other in this way. One of the really interesting findings in this study was that the people who seemed to really do the kind of work that was described in this independent way were often not the analysts themselves. I mean, analysts have the stimulus that they continue to have this with their work with patients. And patients require us to keep doing a lot of self-analysis to see what's going on and to be in touch with ourselves. But there are people who are not analysts who continue to do this in a way that that really seems to have this real functional pleasure that's not about that, that they analyze their dreams, they get excited about what they continue to learn. These are not necessarily analysts. And that's right. The other thing is that the expectation was that self-analysis is something that it's only the analysts that you expect to continue it. And it just wasn't like that in my data. Not that a lot of analysts didn't, but the people who did it in this way that it's described as being stimulated by these other thoughts were more often not. And I think it's this is something about cognitive style much more than something else, I think.
Another important and perhaps surprising finding that of the 82 people, there were two groups, one who were candidates in training and others who were not candidates in training. They were civilians, if you will. And there were a set of expectations about what you would find differently in each group. For example, the fact that candidates would eventually have extensive post-analytic contact with their analysts by virtue of being colleagues. The expectation is that that would change the termination. It might change the nature of grief. It might change how they use the analytic process, none of which proved to be the case. That, like you say, it was far more individual, that you couldn't make generalizations based on the person being a candidate or not.
Right. And, you know, it used to be thought that analysts people in the analytic field would have less grief because they'd have contact with their analysts afterwards. Well, there's a wonderful study done by Heather Craig that shows that's not true. And this study certainly supported that there was no less grief among the candidates. What's different is the nature of the post-analytic contact. And it's actually much more problematic for the candidate because, well, I would say that one way that anyone can have post-analytic contact is to return as a patient. Another myth. Returning as a patient disrupts your assimilation. That just doesn't hold up at all. People return and find it useful to return when they do. And if they don't return and things come up, maybe they go to someone else. In fact, some of these people describe just that. What you gain for some people, maybe it's one experience. For many people, there are returns. And if they find it helpful, they will return when something else comes up. It isn't the expectation that they're going to forever do it by themselves, although they may. And some people use other people in their real life. So that's another myth we had, that returns are going to disrupt.
Right.
But there are two other kinds of post-analytic contact. One that certainly people in the analytic field all encounter, which is that you run into your analyst either at the institute or analytic functions. And what's that contact like? And this can really disrupt the internalization because here, how the analyst deals with this is really crucial. Too much or too little contact, each can have their disruptive, factors in terms of this. This was one of the interesting findings, is how many analysts assume that the patient, because indeed most patients who have had a good ending and had a good analysis, have a very positive feeling about their analyst. And the analyst can confuse this, that it's about them personally, not about them as the analyst. And I don't mean by that, of course, it's about them personally in the sense of how they've been the analyst, but who they are in the role of analyst and who they are in the role of person afterwards are not the same. And that can really disrupt how the former patient feels. In earlier times, I think some people did things that were disruptive in the sense that they would feel like, the analyst would feel like they had to remain like the analyst and were too distant and too remote. And that certainly could make some patients feel bad, and there are people in my study who describe that. But the other side of it is what's more prominent in these findings, which is analysts who assume that the patient would want more contact afterwards, who step into this role. And particularly, as has been cited by others, this is loaded because in the context of having been abstemious in ways not so self-revealing, that it's extra charged when your analyst wants to be your friend or makes overtures like this. And who the analyst is as a person is not necessarily in the totality who the patient needed and wanted in this way. So more often, these relationships disrupt something rather than help something for the patient.
You have examples of analysts reaching out to former patients and suggesting dinners, et cetera, unasked and on their own. And I was surprised when I read that.
Yeah, that's one of the surprising things to me, too. The potential for enactments are really large.
But do you call it enactments if the treatment's ended? That's the question. That's really the difficulty. What do you call it? I mean,
that's not really an enactment.
Right.
An assumption that, here's somebody who you know in depth, and they've been so positively related to you.
Mm-hmm.
But who you really are to them, in some fuller way, it's really loaded.
Yeah, sure.
Hopefully in the analysis, some of that idolization has been worked out. But even if it has, the patient has taken in something that's useful for them, hopefully. The data really shows that the real person of the analyst in a real context of relating is disappointing, because that's, even if this person might be their friend under other circumstances,
right,
this person has served in a different role. And disrupting that and disrupting who this person is to the analysis end, that's really not a service. And I think analysts can be blind about that. I suspected this was true, but the data really confirmed that. Hmm.
And yet the data shows, as you say, both sides, that there are people who are too standoffish post-analysis.
Yes, indeed.
And the former patient feels hurt and rebuffed. So it's a very tough spot.
That's right. It is a tough spot. And so the issue is to find some kind of balance between responsiveness and distance. You don't want to make your patient feel like, they're still on analysis with you.
Right, distance, right.
But you don't want to get ahead of them. And, there are institutes where former analysts and analysts teach together. The people who describe that in general, and it may just be those who describe it, have found it a disaster. I mean, we're all human. We have things.
I didn't get that either.
Been hard to get in the way. And that's fine. We all learn to live with that. But when that person is someone who you've internalized things from in a particular kind of way, it does get in the way. I mean, the data really showed that very clearly.
Yeah. You summarize this conflict very beautifully. Let me read a few sentences that's part of your conclusion about this. Quote, just as each analysis and each termination is unique, dependent upon the character and conflicts of the particular analyst and analytic process and relationship with the analyst, there is no one way to respond to former analysts when encountering them in social or professional situations. What can be concluded from the reports is that transferences do not dissolve with termination, that termination has a power and meaning that is always deeply personal, and that the effect of post-analytic contact is always one of a kind. that really captures the complexity of it, and that there isn't a formula.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. I mean, that's, I think, more than anything else, this is what I was hoping to show, is that there is no one way, and many ways can be ways that are really helpful. It depends. It depends upon the patient. It depends upon the analyst. It depends upon how they fit together and what they can do. And when it works well, it really does do something for people in their lives that's so meaningful and so changing. Hmm. But it can also go badly. And it was interesting to see how many people wanted to come and complain about what really hadn't gone well. And when it didn't go well, it did have to do, now this is during the context of the analysis mainly, but not only, it does have to do with the analyst stepping out of role or not being sensitive to what their role means. And it's hard. Sometimes there are things that are out of analyst control, like having to move or having an illness, but how they dealt with these things were the issue, not the fact of it. I mean, either of those things are going to be awful for any patient, but being secretive, having the analysis discovered in some other way, that's really disruptive.
Perhaps the key point you're making is the analyst not being sensitive to what their role means. That is, that they are not functioning in an object-oriented way, that is, attending to the meaning and experience of the other person, that they're functioning in a narcissistic position, that they have needs that they now want gratified from this analyst and or former analyst and that's what's front and center in their mind. And that's what the analyst and is experiencing, that they're no longer the focus of the person's attention.
Right. And sometimes I think this seems like it was driven by some old notions in theory about analysts as blank screens, which, is just totally unrealistic. And other times it's driven, although I suspect even, more than suspect, I think, choice of theory and how you think about it is a personal issue. But it is... It's not remaining sensitive to who the other person is in their individuality, in their needs. Some patients may want to know more, and it may be useful, although I think you always have to be careful about assuming that and making sure it's not your own needs.
Right.
But some people really don't. And yet it's a balance of not being so remote and unself-revealing that the person feels pushed away.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about this finding of buoyancy. It's a terrific phrase. It really captures an emotional experience. What did you make of that?
Oh, I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the assumptions that we have is that grief occurs in the ending and that the termination is a time where you can mourn, which indeed it is. But it isn't like everything else. It's not inevitable in the way it's been written down. Herb Schlesinger has made the point that in many, many times over the course of analysis, grieving is taking place, mourning is taking place. And for some people, that happens, before the ending. For other people, it's in the ending. But, we have separations all along the way. We're exploring it all along the way. And it just varies. But for some people, and I think this was particularly true for patients who had either been traumatized or really deprived in some ways and had developed a very early self-sufficiency, the analysis enabled them to more comfortably live with their feelings of dependency, to not be afraid of this, to be able to rely on the analyst, sometimes in an idealized way, but in any case, feeling that they've let themselves depend in a way that they really had to cut off prematurely. So when these patients, particularly, come to a point that they feel that they're really ready to function on their own, it the joy that they feel in feeling their own autonomy, the sense of what they can do, is something that's been very hard won because it was developmentally cut off for them way too early. So the ending for them is joyous. I mean, Quinados has a wonderful paper by Quinados about this. And the description is, how does he put it? It's maybe I've gotten written it down because I thought it was so much to the point. Ah, yes, to fly on one's own wings. That's yes. Buoyancy.
But they're real wings. They're not precocious wings. That's the point.
Right. They're real
yes.
Wings.
Right.
There, you know, you can do this, and it's not some great idealized sense of total independence. And
right.
There's a paradox. You see, I think one of the notions that we really held is this notion that someone finishes an analysis and really feels this sense of, you know, they have the analyst inside, they go off on their own.
Sure.
Well, you know, I think that's an idealized version about what happens. But for these people, there's something about that idea that means something different because they had to give up the sense of being dependent, being connected. The analysis enabled them to connect and then to go through a developmental process of separation that they had to give up prematurely. I mean, separation is an issue for everyone, and that's why terminations are hard, and you've let yourself become, if it's worked well, to be intimate and trusting and really having someone who helps you grow in this way. But for these people, before they could enter into that kind of relationship with the analyst, they had to give up this defense of self-sufficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it isn't that we don't want people to be independent this way, but that independence, I think, gets valorized in a way that just isn't what it's like for most people. We have a balance between being attached and being able to do things ourselves. And that's hopefully what we have. And it's not a defense of self-sufficiency.
Right. You're emphasizing the importance of delineating self-sufficiency that's part of a false self from mm-hmm. self-sufficiency that's truly autonomous and vibrant.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, the book is not about the analyst experience, and that's important to recognize that this is listening to analyst hands. One couldn't help, or at least I couldn't help in reading the reports, scratching my head and thinking, I wonder what the analyst would have to say about this. Not to diminish the immediacy and subjective truth for the patient, former patient, but it is a two-person process. And wouldn't it be something to have a book about analysts' experiences of termination of their patients? What brought it to mind was your description of patients discovering their separateness in the termination process, that they hadn't known that they didn't feel separate, and they discovered separateness with all the reactions and histories that are associated with that separateness. But it brought to my mind that the analyst, for the length of these analyses, many of which are long, has been operating under the conditions of lack of separateness on the part of the patient. Now, we are trained for this. We've had our own experiences with it, but it's still something for us to be living with somebody intimately for years, and the person we're living with doesn't recognize that they're not really separate from us. And then they discover it, and they hopefully fly under their own power, as you say. But what's it like for the analyst to be working under those conditions? And what's it like for the analyst to now be sharing that space with someone who recognizes separateness? And might the analyst not also have a sense of buoyancy from a host of possible origins? What do you think?
Oh, I think definitely. And I think, I don't know if you want to get into this, but my earliest book was called The Patient's Impact on the Analyst. So it was in the 1990s at a time when counter transference was something one didn't want to look at, tried to deny was there. And these were people who volunteered to talk about their experiences with their patients and what had been difficult for them or good for them or many things like that. And it's quite interesting. So I actually have a whole thing of analysts' experience about how they feel with their patients, although it's not specifically about endings, although certainly endings are there. But if you're asking in the issue about termination specifically, I think most of us also feel a sense of both satisfaction and loss when a patient who we've worked with for many years is ready to leave. This, you know, what is it to be such a part of somebody's life and in such a deep way and usually for quite a long period of time? And then to have them leave and to know that one of the things that we have to tolerate is when we may never know anymore.
Yeah.
They never tell us what happens in their lives. And personally, I can't imagine not being curious and wanting to know.
Sure.
But there is a deep satisfaction in feeling that somebody who was crippled or limited in some ways in their lives no longer is. And that it's probably like, in some ways, like with your own children, to see them, you know, separate and take off and be able to do that, to be able to fly on their own. It's very exhilarating. It's very, you feel such pleasure in seeing that happen. So this is actually another issue about post-analytic contact. That one of the things that comes up is, well, could you be friends with the patient afterwards? And usually the answer is it gets in the way. Very exhilarating to have shared an experience in depth with another person the way you do with an analyst. You know the inner workings of people's struggles, of their strengths, of the things they overcome. It's, you know, we're granted such a privilege to be part of someone's world and to be able to help them get more freedom and more pleasure in that world. And when it works well, I think we, like the patients, are really exhilarated at the end. There's always a sense of, I think, a little sadness in the sense of, you know you're not necessarily going to know more. And that, of course, is one of the things that becomes so clear, is that I think analysts can forget that and forget that they've been here and been privileged to be part of this aspect of their patient's life. But it doesn't mean that they go on with them with, you know, the next part. Patients are free to return. And I always have a sense of pleasure when I receive a note from a former patient.
Sure.
And some patients do keep in touch. And some patients return and return and do another piece of work. And we have a whole history and background that we can return to that way. But I always have a great sense of pleasure at that point when they feel they've done something they want to do and they can go on. And you have to accept that, unlike your real children, hopefully, who you continue to see in part of your lives, that they may never be again. But what they take away and what they can do is, you know, is thrilling for them. And it's up to them, it seems to me, about whether they want to return, need to return. But that's why it's so important that we stay in this space, that we're a resource for people if they want it. And if they need it, and whatever that may be. I have a few patients who have come back since my training, and they leave and they come back and they leave and they come back. And I'm always really glad to see them, although sorry that they're in some sort of suffering that they have to go through again. But each time they can fly on their own, as Quinidos puts it, it's such a pleasure. It's such a joy feel that and to feel that you've been able to be part of helping someone launch in that way.
Your joy and your thoughtfulness about this work is very available to me and the listeners. Judy, tell us about you and this work, this particular research, which is under the category of the nature of the match. That's been a longstanding focus on your part. The nature of the match between analyst and an analyst. And you've doubled down on that and studied the, as you say, the analyst's experience of it and the analyst and's experience of it. Where does this come from in you?
That's a harder question.
I didn't say it'd be easy.
But let me answer the easier one first.
Okay, all right.
The easier one is there are lots of things that I'm not a researcher by nature. I'm a clinician, and I got trained at a point when psychologists were not given easy access to training, and you had to be a researcher in order to do it. So, you know, I've ended up doing a lot of research, which ended up really interesting me because it gave you so much more opportunity to know so much more about a topic and about people in this way. But I think almost always my research comes with a kind of questioning of authority. I went to a very progressive elementary school, a D-Ed school, a little like the New York Little Red Schoolhouse. It was Brooklyn Community, which is where I was. And one of the things they really did is they taught us to question authority, to not accept what was just told to us. And I guess I took that in a very deep way. So whenever you've got these kind of certainties, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, yeah. And particularly if my own experience says, well, I've experienced something else, and I doubt that I'm that unique. If I've experienced something else, I bet other people have too. Well, let's find out about it. And people are so interesting. I'm sure that's why I do this work. I originally wanted to be a writer of short stories, and I just didn't have that kind of imaginative arc. But it became clear to me that what really interested me was character and conflict. And so this became such a natural fit. I've always had good friends. I've always been interested in people. And to know people in this depth is such a privilege. You know, it really is. So, I mean, I think that's where I start with this in general, in being a researcher. But if you're asking me specifically about this particular work, that's what I would say was my conscious motivation. I think, you know, that we have unconscious motivations, and I learned about mine in relation to this work really over time. And what I learned was not a surprise. It was just the connection that was a surprise. Our youngest child had a brain tumor, and he died at the age of 31. And that was in 2001. Sometime after that, he was a reporter. Very curious, very individual, very, very unique, very wonderful person, and we miss him a lot. But sometime after that, I began this work about writing about patients, and one of my colleagues said to me, "What has gotten you to do this? This is not the kind of thing you usually, you know, think about or write about." The question is, well, what do you do? What do you do about confidentiality? What are the ramifications of these things? And, you know, just a lot of curiosity about what people do. And I said spontaneously, well, I was being like a reporter, at which point I said, I was being like a reporter. I had no conscious recognition that it was an identification of my son who had died. So, similarly, I'll say I was presenting a paper on the paper that appeared in JAPA, which is a psychoanalytic memoir, The Analyst, Enabled and Disabled by What's Personal. And toward the end of the paper, I was talking about the experience of my son's illness and how it affected my work and what I did with this and just a whole thing around grief. And Ruth Imba, who was my discussant, said, and I wonder if this was the motivation for your most recent book at the time, Myths of Termination, Your Interest in Endings. Well, I have to say, I had the same experience I had when my colleague raised this with me, you know, earlier. I had no conscious recognition that that's what I was doing. But I think both of these are instances of a kind of working through of grief that I did in different ways that weren't conscious. And this is part of what's so interesting about us as people. It's we don't always know what we're doing. And sometimes it's just quite adaptive, as I guess these things have been. But I didn't really realize how I was keeping our son close in doing each of these. And I clearly was. You know, it's funny because Ruth at the time was afraid she was being intrusive and that I would mind. But I didn't feel that way at all. I mean, in this way, I value the insight. I value knowing something about myself that I didn't know before. Analysis is a lifelong process.
I was just going to say, Judy, that those vignettes are deeply touching. And thank you for sharing. And you really sum up this work with those vignettes. They are moments of deep friendships that you have with people. They are moments where you can learn about yourself, as we all learn about our unconscious, often surprised. And you do it so easily. I mean, I suspect you take it for granted. You don't really get how gracefully you take in these self-awarenesses and say, oh, wow, that's really interesting, even as, on subjects as exquisitely sensitive as the one we're talking about. And you share how a mind, how a person, how you can always be devoted to being curious, to growing, to receiving the affectionate insights of people who are important to you. That's the sum of this work. If anybody wants to know about what this book is about, just listen to those vignettes. You know, as the saying goes, everything else is commentary. Now read the commentary. The book is really quite special. The book is Myths of Termination, What Patients Can Teach Psychoanalysts About Endings. I will edit that title by saying what Judy Kernschwitz can teach us about endings. Judy, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And thank you, Robert.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.